Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
The man stood up and stretched his back, aching from a long day of sitting and stooping over pages of cramped handwriting. He plucked his hat off the desk and plopped it down on top of his head, then walked out toward the door, leaving behind the cacophonous clamor of a working print shop. Inkers slamming their inkballs onto trays of type, compositors clacking metal pieces of type into the forms, papers crinkling, voices calling out corrections and instructions. Enough of this, thought the man, hollering for an assistant to follow him with a crate of completed volumes. The two men stepped out into the heat of the Venetian summer, grateful for a brief moment of respite as they passed under the shade from the spire of their parish church. It was July of 1499. The man's name was Aldus Manutius. He was a scholar and a printer, somewhat famous among his contemporaries, and Venice had been his home for the last decade. He picked his way through the narrow lanes and winding byways of the city on his way to the booksellers, yelling at his sweating assistant to keep up with the crate. They passed swaggering condottieri, scar-faced mercenaries waiting to ship out to garrison some bleak Greek fortress town against the relentless advance of the Ottoman Turks. The assistant, struggling to see over the crate, bumped into a rotund, richly dressed German, a visiting Augsburg merchant who cursed him in a barely accented Venetian dialect. As they neared the bookseller, Aldus heard the money changers on the Rialto Bridge call out exchange rates. There were spices and silks for sale. Two Venetians haggled over the precise rates on maritime insurance for a particularly risky voyage to Egypt. A group of sailors reeled through the crowd, drunk and enjoying themselves after a trip across the Adriatic Sea to Dubrovnik for timber. The bookseller was just ahead, around that next corner. Aldus picked up the pace and yelled at his assistant once more. Those books wouldn't carry themselves, and he certainly wasn't going to do it. From this spot, Venice's extensive network could take those printed volumes all over the continent. Just one more trade good, flowing through the most commercialized, richest city in Europe, a place where even common sailors could buy shares in trading voyages and do some business of their own. Venice was the hinge of the late medieval world, a center of finance, trade, and innovation. But it was more than that. It was also the center of a unique empire that stretched along the sea lanes of the Mediterranean, protecting and furthering the city's commercial interests. Those two things were not separate. The climate of investment and the ready capital that made it possible for Aldus to be Europe's most famous printer was the product of an active Venetian state willing to raise armies, crew fleets, and go to war to make its citizens richer. Today, follow along as we discuss the rise and fall of the Stato da Mar and the Terra Ferma, the imperial age of a commercial powerhouse. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. Rising up out of a swampy marsh and a relative backwater, Venice was an unlikely candidate to become the hinge of the medieval world. It began as a haven for salt panners and fishermen, expert boatmen plying the lagoons and shallow channels of the Adriatic coast, making a humble life well away from Italy's traditional centers of power. They built tiny communities on the scattered spits of dry earth in their watery home, slowly enlarging the viable land by driving in wooden pilings, filling in channels with rubble, and bridging the gaps to create a larger community. Over the course of the shadowy early medieval centuries, the Venetians built robust political institutions and a thriving economy centered on overseas trade. They started to extend their influence and control over the Adriatic Sea and then beyond. By the 12th century, as Europe's commercial revolution was in full swing, Venice was becoming the destination where all the medieval world's trade routes converged. Spices and silks from the distant east, textiles from the north, slaves, metals, weapons, timber, grain. All of it flowed through the bustling port of Venice, moved onward by Venetian merchants, hungry for profits, who served as the indispensable middlemen of the medieval economy. This made the Venetians impossibly wealthy and made their city an incredibly innovative and cosmopolitan place, bursting at the seams with new ideas, varied influences, and above all, with money. The Venetians grew even richer when they participated in the Fourth Crusade in 1204, sacking and then capturing Constantinople, the capital of the Byzantine Empire. Venetian crusaders took the choicest bits of art and holy relics from the smoking ruins of the once great city, but that was just the beginning. The new Latin Empire of Constantinople, ruled by expatriate nobles from Western Europe, wasn't much of a state. The Venetians, however, were entitled to, quote, a quarter and half a quarter of the rump state. They carved out an effective seaborne empire from former Byzantine territories, setting up shop in a chain of ports, naval bases, and island strongholds from the Adriatic coast of Greece to Crete and Cyprus in the eastern Mediterranean. Even when the Latin Empire collapsed in 1261, the Venetians kept their hold on what they called the Stato da Mar, the state of the sea. Venetian commerce depended on safe shipping across the Mediterranean, and the Stato da Mar gave them the means of enforcing that safety. Yet everything was not rosy for Venice. The highs of the commercial revolution were coming to an end as the year 1300 approached. The last crusader foothold in the Holy Land, Acre, fell to the Mamluks in 1291. Most dangerous of all, the city of Genoa had emerged as a real threat and rival to Venice. Two wars in the 13th century solved none of the fundamental issues about trade and political influence in the central and eastern Mediterranean that separated Venice and Genoa. Then came the Black Death in the years after 1347, gutting the population of Venice and disrupting trade and commerce all across Europe, the Mediterranean, and beyond. Another war with Genoa followed right after that. One of Venice's most respected politicians, the Doge himself, Marino Faliere, was discovered plotting to overthrow the Republic and turn himself into the city's strongman ruler. The Venetian authorities executed Faliere and his accomplices, but the incident shows just how deep Venice's problems were in the middle of the 14th century. A massive uprising on the island of Crete, Venice's key overseas possession, followed right after. It took a vicious guerrilla war that lasted for years to bring Crete to heel. Venice, the glittering jewel of the Adriatic, the success story of the medieval economy, that engine of innovation, was on the brink of collapse and ruin. And worse, far worse, was yet to come. This was where we left things in our last episode on Venice a few weeks back. We talked about how the city rose from the muck and mire of the lagoon to become a glittering jewel of commerce and wealth, but then faced an increasingly serious series of challenges over the course of the 14th century. Those problems reached a head in the year 1378. Once again, it was Genoa at the core of those issues. Annoying, troublesome, dangerous Genoa. Genoa was Venice's mirror image, located at the top of the Tyrrhenian Sea on the opposite coast of Italy. Both were innovative maritime trading cities with overseas possessions. But where Venice was defined by political stability and strong communal bonds, Genoa was fractious, chaotic, and constantly in a state of upheaval. Its nobles fought each other for control over the city and its politics, retreating to their countryside fortresses when things didn't go their way, then returning to the city and exiling their rivals in turn. Despite its internal problems, Genoa was formidable, wealthy, and bursting with piratical energy. It had fought Venice to a strategic draw three times in increasingly vicious conflicts. Those wars had turned Venice and Genoa from mere commercial rivals to blood foes, and their last conflict would be the worst of them all. As per usual, the Fourth Genoese War began in the eastern Mediterranean. Both Genoa and Venice wanted the key island of Tenedos, a little spit of land with immense strategic value. Tenedos sits near the entrance to the Dardanelles, the narrow strait that leads from the Aegean to Constantinople and from there to the Black Sea. If the Genoese controlled Tenedos, they could prevent the Venetians from reaching the rich trading grounds at and beyond Constantinople. If the Venetians held the island, they could stop the Genoese. The Venetians won out, and Genoa responded with full-scale war. In itself, this was nothing unusual. It was more or less how the previous three conflicts had started, with some minor variations. But this time, the Genoese decided that they needed allies. Venice was not especially popular among its neighbors. The king of Hungary was a rival for control of the Dalmatian coast, the eastern side of the Adriatic Sea, what's now mostly Croatia. This had once belonged to Venice, but it was currently in the king of Hungary's hands. The ruler of the city of Padua, a guy named Francesco da Carrara, was no fan of Venice either. He was afraid of the city's ambitions on the mainland and wanted to thwart them as soon as possible. With Padua and Hungary as allies, Genoa could surround Venice on land, sea, and the rivers. Like a python with its prey, the Allies could slowly squeeze the maritime city to death by cutting off its incoming supplies. Venice would either surrender or starve. The war began well enough for Venice. The Venetians had their own ally, the infamous Bernabo Visconti, the ruler of Milan, soon to be murdered by his treacherous nephew Gian Galeazzo Visconti. We talked about the murderous Viscontis a few months back. So Bernabo sent troops to attack nearby Genoa by land, while a Venetian fleet moved up the west coast of Italy toward the rival city. Meanwhile, Hungarian forces moved overland and linked up with the Paduans, besieging a Venetian possession just 10 miles outside the city, while a Genoese fleet in turn moved north up the Adriatic. By the summer of 1379, the Genoese had crushed the Venetian fleet, cutting off the city by sea. At the same time, the Hungarian and Paduan forces drew the net tighter on land. The Venetian Lagoon, the city's immediate environment, is a maze of channels, marshland, spits of dry land, and shallow waters, with only a few points of entry to the Adriatic and the rivers that lead inland. With enemies approaching, the Venetians completely blocked two of those entrances with chains and sunken hulks. The third, at the southern end, they left open. This was at the small city of Chioggia, and it gave the whole conflict, the War of Chioggia, its name. Chioggia was where the Genoese, Paduans, and Hungarians all converged. If they could take and hold Chioggia, they would have a viable base in Venetian home waters. It would only be a matter of time until they could squeeze Venice into submission. Chioggia held out for more than a week in the face of overwhelming odds and inflicted brutal casualties on the attacking enemies, but eventually it fell. The Venetians knew their end was near. They offered an essentially unconditional surrender as long as the city retained its independence, but the Genoese commander, Pietro Doria, refused, hands down. "There will be no peace until we have first put a bridle on those horses of yours on the portico of St. Mark's," Doria replied. He was referring to the famous bronze statue of four horses looted from Constantinople in 1204 that sat on the city's basilica. It was a symbol of Venice and Venetian power. Bridling the horses meant ending Venice as an independent force. Venice responded to Doria with firm resolution. The authorities collected emergency loans to fund the war effort. Everybody turned out to dig earthworks, patrol the waters around the city, and man the defenses. But there was division, too. The common people felt the nobles who dominated government weren't doing their share, and they despised the man the Venetian Senate had chosen for overall command. In return for their ongoing support, the people of Venice demanded that command be handed over to a guy named Vettore Pisani, a swashbuckling adventurer whom the commoners dearly loved. There was just one problem. Pisani was currently locked in a dungeon. He had been the commander of the Venetian fleet the Genoese had crushed earlier that year, and while his subordinates had forced him into a fight he knew he couldn't win, the ultimate responsibility for the defeat rested on his shoulders. Pisani's failure had very nearly earned him an execution. With the people on the verge of open rebellion, the Venetian Senate debated what to do. The populace eventually forced their hand. They hammered on the door of the Senate chamber, chanting, "Vettore Pisani!" Finally, the Senate relented and put Pisani in charge. The city was still in serious danger, but at least it had a leader the populace would follow. Almost on cue, the Genoese and their allies renewed the attack. The Venetians beat them back, holding one of the sandbars that protected the city from the Adriatic and the southern defenses, but the net closed tighter and tighter around Venice. The Genoese were close enough that their flag could be seen from the bell tower of St. Mark's Basilica. Only one tenuous land route brought food and supplies into the city. The war degenerated into a grinding siege. Nobody knew the labyrinthine passages of the lagoon better than the Venetians, and they hit the attackers in guerrilla-style water raids whenever they could. Pisani came up with a bold plan. The Genoese, Paduans, and Hungarians thought they had the Venetians trapped. But what if they could turn the tables on their besiegers and turn them into the besieged, locking the Genoese up in Chioggia? It was risky, but it made sense. There were only a few ways in and out of the lagoon. If the Venetians could further block those entrances, they would have the upper hand. The whole city threw itself into the effort, constructing new galleys and training novices in the art of rowing and seaborne warfare. In December of 1379, Pisani launched the attack. It cost a huge number of lives, but the Venetians succeeded in sinking hulks to block the main channel the Genoese had been using to bring supplies into the lagoon. Soon after, Pisani blocked the other two channels. Now, it was the Genoese who were trapped. Another Venetian fleet had been out raiding Genoese possessions and shipping in the eastern Mediterranean. It returned, blockading the seaborne supply lines the Genoese had been using to support themselves. A Genoese relief fleet couldn't get through the blockade. The Paduans still held the rivers, but they too couldn't get through to relieve the Genoese in Chioggia. Month after month, this went on. Finally, starving and shattered, the Genoese and their allies surrendered on June 30th, 1380. The allies were released, but the Venetians took their hated Genoese enemies to appalling prison camps, where many of them died of disease and starvation. The fighting dragged on for another year, but the war was effectively over. Venice had survived by the skin of its teeth. The peace treaty basically restored the status quo ante bellum, but the differences between Venice and Genoa were never so clear as in the aftermath. Genoa fell apart at the seams. Its general air of chaos exploded into open internal conflict. Eventually, with no better options, the city surrendered itself to the King of France in the hopes that he could restore something like order. Venice, by contrast, recovered immediately. The city reinforced its control over its colonial possessions in the Mediterranean, establishing itself as the major maritime power of the region. And Venice started to build a land empire, the Terraferma, to match the Stato da Mar. The War of Chioggia had been devastating, but Venice emerged from it stronger, ready to blossom into a genuine power.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Takeoff 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
As the historian Dennis Romano points out in his book, The Likeness of Venice, one of the great ironies of the city's long and successful run as an independent power is how few truly famous Venetians there were. This was especially true in the realm of politics. We have the blind doge, Enrico Dandolo, who masterminded the conquest of Constantinople in 1204, and maybe for the real Venice heads out there, that Vettore Pisani I just talked about. That's really it. A city located in a dismal marsh with no more than 150,000 inhabitants at its peak acquired large swaths of territory in Italy and the Mediterranean. Venice successfully prosecuted wars and established itself as the commercial center of the continent. And yet we don't have famous doges, generals, and admirals to hold up as the faces of that success. We just have the city itself. That's an irony to be sure, but it tells us something really important about Venice. Venice's success wasn't due to some remarkably talented, charismatic rulers who happened to pop up here and there. Venice didn't have a St. Louis or Richard the Lionheart or Henry V, or even a Francesco Sforza, the condottiere who became Duke of Milan. The fact was that it didn't need one. Venice had layers of governance and elite rivalries, groups of wealthy and powerful families who competed for control of official posts and unofficial levers of power within a fairly tame set of rules. These groups of elites might quarrel and argue and even depose one another from time to time, but there was very little blood in the streets or assassination of the kind that plagued other Italian city-states. That was the genius of Venice. Systems and networks, kin groups and aligned interests that came together to form a political order that remained stable for a very long time. Venice's rivals couldn't say the same thing. Genoa, as we've seen, was a mess. Milan was dominated by ambitious signori, dictatorial lords who varied in their capabilities. Milan also vacillated between the rule of signori and short-lived attempts at restoring republican rule. The same was true of many other smaller cities in Venice's vicinity. Naples had its kings and a long history of outside interventions. Until the Medici took over, Florence went through its fair share of upheavals. Now, Venice wasn't immune to internal problems, as we saw with the clamor for Vettore Pisani at the height of the War of Chioggia and Marino Faliere's failed coup before that, but it had far fewer issues than its Italian compatriots. It wasn't unchanging or unchallenged or without conflict, but the core of Venetian political life survived the most extreme tests without disintegrating. That relative stability at the center enabled Venice to build a miniature empire for itself. Aside from the chunk the Venetians acquired in 1204, this was a slow, up and down, but consistent process of acquisition. We've talked about the Stato da Mare before, Venice's overseas holdings. It wasn't always the same. The Venetians lost the Dalmatian coast to the King of Hungary in 1358, but compensated by purchasing the island of Corfu off the west coast of Greece a bit later. They also held the ports of Modon, Cora, and Negroponte along the Greek coast, giving them a series of naval bases, and the island of Crete. A smattering of other possessions, some of them long-term and others temporary, completed the chain into the eastern Mediterranean. This amounted to a series of key ports and naval bases, stopovers for Venetian merchant ships in a dangerous and inhospitable sea. If Venice went to war with Genoa again, for example, convoys could take shelter at one of those places. War fleets could recruit rowers and soldiers and take on supplies while avoiding storms. For a state built on profitable trading via predictable sea lanes, the Stato da Mare was absolutely indispensable. With the Byzantines in retreat, the Hungarians occupied with succession disputes, and no dominant power yet emerging in the eastern Mediterranean, there were opportunities for Venice to expand the Stato da Mare in the 15th century. Between 1380 and 1420, Venice more than doubled the size of its overseas holdings. I mentioned Corfu, Modon, Cora, and Negroponte, but they also took cities along the Dalmatian coast that had formerly belonged to the Hungarians. Greek cities like Argos and even Athens and Thessalonica briefly came into their hands. This was an opportunistic process. Sometimes the Venetians bought a place outright, like the city of Zara, now Zadar in Croatia. Other times they made deals with the local nobility for voluntary submission to Venetian power, like with Argos in Greece. The city of Durazzo, present-day Durres in Albania, came to Venice through inheritance. Its former ruler left the town to Venice on his death, something that happened a few times. And a few they conquered outright. The upshot was that this evolving collection of overseas territories, the backbone of Venice's commercial success abroad, reached its greatest extent in the aftermath of a war that nearly destroyed Venice itself. So, how did the Stato da Mare work? Well, first, we have to note what it was and what it wasn't. Thinking of the Stato da Mare as a territorial empire with Venetian officials out in some random Balkan pasture doing a tax census is the wrong image. Outside of Crete, which was an exception for a few reasons, the Venetians had effectively no interest in controlling rural territory. They didn't even much care about controlling territory writ large at all. Their empire was almost entirely an empire of cities, islands of urban control in the midst of rural hinterlands. The Venetians were city folk, and they conceived of the world through that lens. cities, and their catchment areas rather than blank space on a map. The Venetians wanted the ports. They wanted the markets. They wanted the wealthy urban elites of those places who could offer them taxes and meaningful support. Sure, they were interested in grain and animal products, but not the fields and flocks that produced them, at least not directly. Why spend your time and resources on those things when you could control the places that channeled them where they needed to go, the markets that made them profitable and useful trade goods? The historian D.S. Chamber sums it up like this, quote, "The Venetian Empire was essentially a commercial enterprise. The most vital organs of the empire were, therefore, warehouses, ships' holds, barges, and pack horses." As the owners of a commercial empire, the Venetians weren't really iron fist types. Violence, the Venetians knew, was usually bad for business. That's not to say there was no threat of violence behind their control. Venetian war fleets and mercenary armies were plenty destructive, and they weren't shy about using them when necessary, but they always weighed the costs and the benefits carefully. Instead, the Venetians generally ruled through enforced consensus. They found partners among the local elites in the cities they owned or wanted to own and encouraged them, offering them status and material rewards in return for their support of Venetian rule. These cities then received Venetian protection from external threats, of which there were many. We'll talk more about those threats shortly, especially the Ottomans. This isn't necessarily groundbreaking stuff. In fact, most empires throughout history, from the Persians to the British, have relied on some form of consensus rule. It turns out that it's pretty hard to maintain rule through fear over a large area, and it's prohibitively expensive to retain a huge standing army that can enforce violent control. The Romans dealt with local elites on a massive scale, turning them into their local and regional agents of empire. To liaise with these local elites, the empire usually sent out agents of its own. The relationship between the imperial center and the controlled peripheries usually came down to the relationship between these key power brokers. The imperial center's touch could be lighter or heavier, more direct or more oblique, more or less freighted with violent intent, and could vary greatly from territory to territory, precisely what the imperial center wanted from that particular place. This is what the Venetians did. We're lucky to have a really excellent recent book on this topic by the historian Monique O'Connell called Men of Empire, Power and Negotiation in Venice's Maritime State. So, Venice appointed a number of officials to a variety of posts in its overseas territory. It drew from the rich, politically active patrician families who made up Venice's elite. Key territories got both governors, who handled judicial and financial affairs, and captains, who were responsible for military affairs. Some of these posts were more sought after than others and got larger staffs. Being the governor or captain of the island of Crete or the city of Zara in what's now Croatia was a big deal. Only the most experienced and most highly placed patricians got these posts. They had a bunch of subordinates, including fortress commanders, advisors, and financial administrators. At the opposite end of the spectrum, less important places like the fortress island of Monomvasia in Greece got a single lowly official with a small entourage every couple of years and didn't even have a permanent official there. These minor offices were something like public welfare for the less successful members of the Venetian elite. They could get a minor job and a salary from time to time. For the most part, though, appointments went to people who were capable of doing the job. There was a baseline expectation of competence. In the grand scheme of things, this was a pretty light imperial touch. The Venetian elite wasn't large, just a few thousand people, and they ran the whole empire. Office holding ran in families. It could be a rite of passage for a member of a prominent family, the heir holding the same jobs his father had a generation earlier. Even more than that, individuals and families tended to specialize in particular places within the Stato de Mare. The Boldu family went to Crete over and over again in the middle of the 15th century. Five brothers served as everything from treasurer to judge over a 40-year period in various places on the island. The Boldu family was typical. Other kin groups picked a particular job and stuck to it. Some repeatedly became captains of state galleys, for example. As the historian O'Connell puts it, quote, "Venetian councils awarded offices to individuals. Venetian political life, on the other hand, was a family business." There was obviously real potential for abuse in a system like this, so the Venetians did their best to align the interests of their officials with the interests of the state. They were paid a good salary and received real prestige. But in return, they were expected to refrain from commercial activities while they were in office. They couldn't accept gifts from the locals. They were discouraged from socializing in general. An official was supposed to keep his personal interests separate from those of the state. In practice, of course, none of that was really the case. The state didn't have the capacity to regulate its officials completely. As long as they didn't rile up the people they governed, it was pretty much all kosher. Stability and predictability, rather than tight control, were the goals. No good Venetian, raised in a culture of intense commercial competition, was going to pass up good opportunities for profitable business. The Venetian state didn't really expect its officials to pass them up either, just to keep everything in line. So if you were a good Venetian patrician sent out to one of the holdings in the Stato de Mar, how would that benefit you? Well, you could acquire some property, possibly at a nice discount. You could quietly pocket some gifts from members of the local elite in return for using your contacts back home in their favor. Above all, you could marry a daughter of that local elite, cementing the connection for a long time. This happened all the time. It's part of the reason we see repeated family specializations in particular places. From that base, an enterprising patrician could build up significant property holding and commercial interests in a particular corner of the Stato de Mar. Everybody benefited. The locals could tie themselves to the patrician's patronage networks and improve their odds with the Venetian legal system while building up business relationships. The patricians got to play patron and acquire a range of material advantages. Even if they were officially frowned upon, these kinds of informal and formal ties were the grease that lubricated the whole Venetian imperial system. This was a system built on both institutional and personal relationships. The buy-in of the local bigwigs, whether in Crete or Dubrovnik or Corfu, was essential to making things work. Officials greasing palms and making deals with those local elites, and local elites greasing their palms in return, was a key part of how the Venetians ran their empire. The real losers in this system were the peasants and the common people of the Stato de Mar. They didn't get a voice, and nobody was especially interested in what they wanted. If the local nobles with powerful Venetian patrician allies were abusing a community of Cretan peasants, well, tough luck. Nobody was going to stand up for them. Now, there were limits to all of this. Officials could only go so far before they started to toe the line between effective work and corruption. Embezzlement, bribery, scheming to gain an office or to avoid one. These were all things that got officials in trouble at various points. It was entirely possible for an officeholder to find himself hauled in front of a Venetian court. He might have too blatantly benefited himself, acting against, quote, God, justice, and the honor of our dominion, thereby angering the state or giving an opportunity to a powerful Venetian rival family to attack him. Or he might have caused, quote, scandal and murmuring among the subjects residing in his assigned area, picking the wrong allies, or not spreading the wealth of his patronage broadly enough. For example, in 1486, a Venetian official named Girolamo di Mose Venier got in trouble for colluding to get a town doctor elected for a second term in the city of Spalato, and he was forced to return to Venice immediately to defend himself. Venier won his trial and got to go back to Spalato, and even collected his full salary. Now, this was basically a conflict within the Venetian elite. One of Venier's rivals, a guy named Andrea da Pizarro, had been the one to bring the charges, and Venier had effectively outwitted him at the trial. This kind of thing was common. It was part of the song and dance of infighting within the Venetian elite. It was a big part of what kept the Stato de Mar, and Venice more broadly, healthy and functioning, and a way for patricians to blow off steam and play out their rivalries in productive ways. If the threat of a corruption charge was enough to keep somebody in line, well, all the better. We've focused mostly on the overseas territories here, but the mirror image of the Stato de Mar was the Terraferma, an area of Venetian control within northern Italy. Up until the 15th century, Venice was almost entirely a maritime power. Part of what had drawn Padua into an alliance with Genoa in the War of Chioggia in 1378 was the fact that Venice had acquired a patch of territory in mainland Italy, centered around the city of Treviso, some 20 miles up the road from the lagoon. This was a small bit of land, but it was enough to cause concern among Venice's neighbors. Concern meant war, and lots of it. As we talked about back in the episode on Italian politics a few months back, Italy at this time was embroiled in a long, ongoing series of conflicts. The historian Guido Ruggiero called this the Italian Hundred Years' War, the mirror image of the conflict between France and England that dominated northern European politics for more than a century. The rough outline is that Italian states fought each other incessantly from the middle of the 14th century to the middle of the 15th. As much as Venice might have wanted to concentrate on its overseas holdings, it couldn't avoid being drawn into the affairs of Milan, Florence, Naples, Padua, and the rest. In true Venetian fashion, they played the game of Italian politics just as carefully as they had the Mediterranean scene, and found long-term advantages in their opponents' instabilities. Over the first half of the 15th century, the Venetians slowly but surely acquired a large swath of territory that effectively made them the masters of northern Italy. Ravenna and Rimini to the south, Padua, Verona, and Bergamo to the west, Aquileia and Pola to the east. The Venetian land empire stretched from the eastern coast of the Adriatic in what's now Croatia, which they'd reacquired from the Hungarians in the 1430s, almost to the gates of Milan. The Venetians ruled these lands, called the terra firma, much as they did the Stato di Mar, through consensus, negotiation, and the cooperation of local elites and Venetian officials. Venetians acquired property and business interests in their newly acquired territories and put down some roots. They maintained official and unofficial ties of exactly the kind they did overseas. The acquisition of the terra firma came at a challenging time for Venice. Even as they expanded their hold on the mainland, sending out condottieri and diplomats and cutting deals with the elites of cities like Padua and Ravenna, they were under pressure overseas. The Ottomans, a foe unlike any the Venetians had ever faced, were on the move.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
Things were never easy for Venice. From the very beginning, the city faced challenge after challenge. From the natural environment, from pirates in the Adriatic, Normans and Byzantines, the Genoese, and so on. Aside from the conquest of Constantinople in 1204 and the acquisition of territories that followed, there was no grand moment or great hero of the Venetian imperial age. It was about families and networks and systems and the slow, steady process of expansion, always balanced with strategic retreats when the cost-benefit analysis wasn't favorable. Over and over again, the Venetian order produced skilled, if not especially famous, leaders who could guide the ship of state through treacherous political currents. The Venetians were merchants and investors looking for profits, not warrior nobles trying to attain chivalrous glory through feats of arms. War was a drain on state resources. It was bad for business. Still, war was often unavoidable, and the Venetians were perfectly willing to fight when necessary, particularly if the odds were in their favor. They navigated the difficult straits of politics with aplomb, engaging diplomatically where they could, but also going to war repeatedly if they had to. Their major foes in the first half of the 15th century were the Viscontis of Milan, and eventually Venice came out on top. It's not an exaggeration to paint this as a victory of systems over dynasts. The Doge Francesco Foscari ruled Venice for 34 years, from 1423 to 1457, but his family did not dominate government despite its best efforts, and his overambitious son died in exile. The vast and expanding sweep of the terra firma, the land empire, was the direct result of this systemic redundancy. But the rise of the terra firma coincided with serious troubles in the Stato di Mar. The root of that trouble was the Ottoman Empire. It's been a while since we talked about the Ottomans, but here's a brief refresher. The Ottomans got their start as one of a great many warring groups of Turks in Anatolia, to the east of Constantinople, in the no man's land between the Byzantines, the Crusader states, the Mamluks, and the Seljuk Turks. Slowly but surely, the Ottoman dynasts attracted warriors to their cause in pursuit of glory, plunder, and holy war, and they transformed their marauding supporters into the basis of a state. The weakness of the Byzantines gave them ample opportunities to expand. In the 1350s, the Ottomans took advantage of a Byzantine civil war to cross over and establish themselves on the European side of the Aegean Sea. From their base at Gallipoli, the same Gallipoli that became famous during the First World War, the Ottomans expanded into the Balkans. By 1390, they controlled most of what's now Bulgaria and Serbia, along with chunks of Albania and Greece. Constantinople was almost entirely surrounded by Ottoman territory. The Venetians watched all this with growing alarm. Remember, they controlled large portions of the Balkan coastline and maintained outposts in the Aegean. Ottoman expansion meant that their territory now rubbed up against one another. But the Venetians, as always, were cautious. They didn't take any action that could offend the rising power of the sultans, but they didn't ally with them either, as the Genoese had done on occasion. When the disastrous Crusade of Nicopolis deposited thousands of French, Burgundian, Hungarian, and German crusaders in Ottoman territory in 1396, the Venetians just watched and waited. Their only participation came in the form of picking up a few survivors in the aftermath of the shattering Ottoman victory. As Roger Crowley points out in his book City of Fortune, nobody in Europe spent as much time trying to understand the Ottomans as the Venetians did. They invested over the course of decades in diplomacy and institutional knowledge. More than anybody else, the Venetians grasped just how powerful, relentless, and dangerous the Ottomans really were. As early as 1360, when the Ottomans had only just established themselves in Europe, the Venetians were already sending ambassadors to chat with the Sultan. They made contacts with Ottoman officials, engaged spies, passed around gifts and bribes, and employed a mixture of friendliness and calculated hostility. The Ottomans were always most vulnerable in the civil wars that inevitably followed a sultan's death, and the Venetians were quite happy to support pretenders and play multiple sides to their advantage. But conflict was inevitable. Raiders based in Ottoman territory constantly crossed into Venetian lands in Greece and the Balkans. They looted and burned, either with official Ottoman approval or at least without incurring the sultan's wrath for their actions. More seriously, from the Venetian perspective, Ottoman ships attacked Venetian merchantmen at every opportunity. Finally, in 1416, things came to a head. A Venetian galley squadron headed to Gallipoli and ran afoul of an Ottoman fleet. In the ensuing engagement, the Venetians crushed the Ottoman galleys. To ensure the Ottomans couldn't just rebuild their fleet, the Venetians put all the prisoners to death. Christian renegades among the Ottoman sailors suffered the worst fate. Many of them were impaled on the shore in full view of surviving Ottomans, and the Venetian commander personally hacked a notorious Cretan defector named Giorgio Kalergis to pieces on the deck of his ship. This was the opening salvo in a series of wars that would last, off and on, for more than 300 years. In 1423, 7 years later, the Venetians took over the city of Thessalonica in Greece. The Byzantines were in the midst of their interminable upheavals and slow decline, and they knew there was no way for them to hang on to it in the face of Ottoman aggression. The Venetians, led by an ambitious and talented new doge named Francesco Foscari, knew that taking Thessalonica was a gamble. It would anger the powerful Ottomans and cost them money and resources to hang on to it. But if they could keep Thessalonica, then they'd have a lucrative port and a market, not to mention an exceptionally strategic naval base, right in the heart of the Aegean. So the Venetians gambled, and they lost. The Ottomans attacked Thessalonica immediately, kicking off a 7-year conflict. The Ottomans tirelessly besieged the city, while the Venetians sacked Gallipoli, allied with rival Muslim dynasties in Asia Minor, and tried to buy off the Sultan Murad. Murad was having none of it. "The city is my inheritance," Murad told Venetian ambassadors, "and my grandfather Bayezid took it from the Greeks by his own right hand. Go, if you like. If not, I am coming quickly." That sums up what made the Ottomans such terrifying foes. Their resources, dedication, and sheer competence were a tall order for any opponent. It took all of Venice's deep reserves of craftiness just to hold them off. The Venetians did nothing that could cause outright war with the Ottomans for decades afterward. They didn't participate at all in the disastrous Crusade of Varna in 1443 to 1444. When the even more terrifying Sultan Mehmed II attacked Constantinople in 1453, plenty of Venetians fought to defend it, but the Venetian state only surreptitiously aided the beleaguered city. And when Constantinople fell, the Venetians sent ambassadors to Mehmed, congratulating him on the acquisition of his new capital and secured trading rights. There was just no room for sentiment or hard feelings where Venice's strategic interests were concerned. Constantinople had fallen. The Venetian defenders, impaled or beheaded, were dead. There was no changing any of that, so why dwell on it? Mehmet always had bigger plans. That, and a particular brand of ruthless effectiveness that was extreme even by Ottoman standards, was his defining characteristic. Constantinople wasn't enough. He conquered Wallachia and Bosnia and took part of the Albanian coastline, again rubbing right up against Venetian territories on the Adriatic. Italy was his eventual goal, and everybody knew it. Mehmet was a singular threat, which the Venetians knew better than anyone. That was probably why they authorized no fewer than 14 separate attempts to assassinate him between 1456 and 1479, offering payments of up to 10,000 gold ducats to do it. For reference, that would have been a good year's profit for the Venetian branch of the Medici Bank. Another war was inevitable, and Venice was determined not to fight the Ottomans alone. They lobbied the Pope for a crusade, and while Pope Pius was an incredible humanist and a scholar, he wasn't much of an advocate for the kind of full-scale effort that would be necessary to turn back the Ottoman tide. The Venetians wanted to protect their empire, of course, and they rightly pointed out that nobody else was standing in the way of the Ottoman advance. Venice's Italian compatriots, like Florence and Naples, were more concerned about Venetian ambitions on the Terra Firma than the Ottoman threat. Pius couldn't convince them otherwise. Nobody showed up for the crusade. Venice was left to fight alone against the largest, most powerful state of the day. Considering the imbalance in capabilities between an Ottoman state that stretched from the Euphrates to the Adriatic and the Venetian Empire, as wealthy as it was, it's incredible that the war wasn't more of a disaster for the Venetians. Starting in 1464, the Venetians doggedly resisted the inexorable tide of the Ottoman attack. They even had some offensive success, seizing Ottoman fortresses in southern Greece, but that was short-lived. Whenever Mehmet had an opportunity to turn his attention toward the Venetians, they suffered. In 1470, his gaze fell on the Venetian-held island of Negroponte, off the eastern coast of Greece and the Aegean. Negroponte was the linchpin of Venice's strategic position in that part of the world. Its shipping to the Black Sea depended on it, and so did Venice's ability to project naval power into the eastern Mediterranean. Mehmet wouldn't be denied. He brought an enormous force, a huge train of artillery, and sacrificed thousands of soldiers in increasingly desperate frontal assaults on Negroponte's impressive fortifications. He had allies inside the fortress town, too, including a key mercenary commander who had agreed to secretly let the Ottomans into the town. Mehmet had planted agents inside Venetian territory years before and used them to make contact with the mercenary commander, a guy named Tommaso Schiavo. Schiavo's brother was tortured into giving up the plot, and Schiavo himself was murdered in the middle of town. The authorities left his body hanging upside down in public as a warning to other would-be traitors. The Venetians then turned the tables on the Ottomans. They raised the signal that the Ottomans had agreed on with Schiavo, and when they attacked, the Venetians cut them down en masse. It still wasn't enough. When a Venetian relief fleet appeared, cautiously viewing the situation, Mehmet launched one final attack before it could swing into action. This one succeeded. Mehmet ordered that every male over the age of 10 in Negroponte be executed. The women and children were sold into slavery. After that, the Ottoman advance continued inexorably, draining Venice of hundreds of thousands of ducats and expenses every year, and still they fought on. Ottoman raiders got within 30 miles of Venice itself, lighting fires that could be seen from the city. Finally, in 1479, the Venetians had enough. Negroponte was gone for good, and so was the key port of Scutari, modern Shkuder in Albania, on the Dalmatian coast. It cost 100,000 ducats in gold and upfront payments, and 10,000 more per year. That was a small price compared to what they'd been spending on the war, though. The average annual cost had skyrocketed to 1.25 million ducats per year, an absolutely astronomical sum. Sure enough, with Venice and the Ottomans at peace, Mehmet turned his attention to Italy proper. His forces crossed the Adriatic in 1480 and landed at Otranto, in the heel of Italy, and laid waste the whole region. It was exactly what the Venetians had said would happen, and the event shocked all of Christendom. If Mehmet hadn't died the following year, aged just 49, then all of Italy might have fallen to the Ottomans in short order. But Mehmet did die, and Christendom got a brief respite as the inevitable civil war broke out to determine the next sultan. It would be another 20 years before another war broke out in 1499. This one was sharper and shorter, lasting until 1503, and it was less uneven. The Venetians lost the vital ports of Modin and Cora in southern Greece, but gained some valuable territories along the Adriatic coast. Luckily for the Venetians, they were able to gain some direct military support from the Catholic monarchs of Spain, who helped offset the massive disadvantage the Venetians faced against the Ottomans. Still, there was no mistaking the general trajectory of the Stato de Mare. Whenever the Ottomans devoted sufficient attention to the task, they could pick off key ports, islands, and even win naval victories over the vaunted Venetian fleets. Venice excelled at maximizing its resources. Its tax system was efficient and innovative. It had a public debt as early as 1285, taking out loans and paying interest on them over the long term at very low rates. Public confidence in the tax regime was high. Even as the cost of making war ballooned to incredible highs, the Venetian state still inspired enough belief in its ability to pay out that there was no shortage of funds. A city of 150,000 people, with limited support from its imperial subjects, held off a state with millions of residents for decades. And the long conflicts with the Ottomans, paid for by Venetian cash, were one of the major testing grounds for the military innovations that would eventually dominate the Italian Wars of the 16th century. As the Stato de Mare slowly receded from its high points toward Venice itself, the expanding Terraferma likewise came under attack. The French King Charles VIII invaded Italy in 1494, bringing a train of cannon and a new age of power politics to the peninsula. Venice couldn't avoid getting involved. All went well at first, but in the third phase, beginning in 1508, Venice found itself the target of the combined wrath of several great powers, including France, Spain, and the Holy Roman Empire. The city hung on by the skin of its teeth and retained much of its territory in northern Italy, but by 1530, it was clear that Italy was now a playground for much bigger bullies than the Venetians had ever been. The wars with the Ottomans continued, but even their focus had shifted to the larger Mediterranean battleground. Venice had other issues. The new routes to India opened up by the Portuguese were shifting centuries-old patterns of trade in silk and spices that had made the city rich since before the year 1000. When word of Vasco da Gama's voyage reached Venice, the Venetians immediately grasped its importance. Quote, "At the receipt of this news, the whole city was dumbfounded," wrote the diarist Girolamo Priuli. The wisest thought it the worst news ever heard. Trade had made Venice rich. And now those sought-after goods could be purchased elsewhere at much lower prices. The Venetians, merchants to the core, understood markups and profit margins better than anybody else. Even so, Venice was still rich, still a key trading city, the heart of a territorial state, and increasingly an industrial center with its famous glassmaking. As Aldus Manutius demonstrates, the city was one of the early centers of printing. But the world was changing around it. The currents and patterns that had made Venice wealthy and powerful were shifting for good. The Mediterranean had been the center of the world, and Venice had been the center of the center. Now, both were increasingly backwaters. The Atlantic and the Pacific, the Indian Ocean and the South China Sea, that was where the real action was. Venice's wealth transformed into fine palazzi and opera houses. The city's age of commercial glory became fodder for nostalgia and decadence. It became a tourist attraction. If you can visit Venice today, you should take the opportunity. It's a magical place, a city that shouldn't exist, a testament to a bygone age and its mishmash of hundreds of long past influences. Feel the unsteady ground beneath your feet, dodge the puddles of rising water, smell the decay and feel the heat of the lagoon. There's nowhere like it. As you look around, know that you're in the heart of a bygone past, the hinge of the medieval world. Next time on Tides of History, we'll be moving on to a more thematic topic: merchants, markets, and how you could do business in the late Middle Ages. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman.
Sound design by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe and Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Once Upon a Beat.